is so much in the news these days about concussions, what they are, what they're not, how they impact us, that today's guest is here to help us understand concussions and actually a whole lot more. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk, and I am pleased to welcome again Dr. Jonathan Romain from Chalk Children's Hospital. Dr. Romain, welcome.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Chalk Children's, where you're located, that kind of stuff.
So Chalk Children's Hospital is in Orange County, California. We have a variety of different programs here, part of which is a neuroscience center. And in that neuroscience center, we provide treatment for epilepsy and a variety of other neurological conditions, as well as concussion.
And Dr. Romain, folks, for those of you who may not have heard him when he was on the program the last time, he is a board-certified he's board-certified in clinical neuropsychology and pediatric neuropsychology with an expertise on the evaluation of complex neurological disorders in school-aged pediatric patients. He's on the medical staff, as you heard a moment ago, of Chalk Children's Hospital in Orange County, California, and he is a health sciences associate clinical professor in the Department of Pediatrics at University of California, Irvine School of Medicine. Again, Dr. Romain, we're happy to have you here, and let's start off with you explaining what exactly is a concussion.
So a concussion is on the spectrum of head injury, and it requires a force and a response. So if brain sits in the skull, there is a significant amount of force that causes changes in neurophysiology within the brain. That's essentially what a concussion is. It's a force that's significant enough to disrupt thinking, processing, and some aspect of neurocognitive function. That could be from a sports injury, that could be from a car accident, that could be from a fall.
So is a concussion something that's relatively easy to occur?
Well, I think it certainly depends on the activity that you're involved in. So if you're in an impact sport, something like football or boxing, or a contact sport, which would be something like soccer or basketball, you are at greater risk for having a concussion. So they do happen with some degree of frequency.
Is there a difference between a traumatic brain injury and a concussion?
Yes, there's a huge difference between the two, in my opinion. So a traumatic brain injury, at least how we define it in the field, is that's when you have that same kind of injury, but it results in contusions or some other type of bleed within the brain or some other major disruption, and usually defined by a lesion or some type of damage that you see on neuroimaging. And often these injuries do have some persistent symptoms for quite a while and sometimes permanent. With a concussion, yes, we can see permanent symptoms, but typically we do not. So that would be kind of one of the major distinctions. Also, a concussion is, again, more of a physiological change in neurochemistry in the brain, where, again, that more kind of severe or moderate traumatic brain injury is a result of shearing of white matter tracts or some other type of bleed within the brain or secondary injury as a result of that primary head injury.
So am I correct in understanding that with a concussion, there is a greater possibility for a full recovery than with traumatic brain injury?
Absolutely, absolutely. There is compelling research out there that says, upwards of 95% of all individuals will recover completely and spontaneously, sometimes with a little bit of extra time and support, with a concussion. With traumatic brain injury, again, head injury is kind of on a spectrum where concussion is kind of at the more mild end of things, and severe traumatic brain injury would be at the kind of more severe end. Severe traumatic brain injury would be things like a length of coma that's in excess of 48 hours. Those kinds of things would define a severe traumatic brain injury. And then we have a moderate traumatic brain injury, which would be a little bit less severe than a severe traumatic brain injury. And then we have this, what we call a complicated mild traumatic brain injury, which would be, it's kind of like a concussion, but you will also have some blood product on neuroimaging.
And it is also more likely to have longer lasting effects than a concussion, yes?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. What are the emotional or behavioral differences between, well, let's just focus on concussion for the moment. Are there emotional, psychological, behavioral effects post-concussion experience?
So the three symptoms that I look for with concussion are, one, in the realm of physical, so things like headache, dizziness, sensitivity to light or sound. The second would be cognitive changes. Cognitive changes include difficulty with attention, maybe confusion, difficulty with what we call short-term or working memory, so keeping information in mind to process. And then the third category would be behavioral changes. And so when we have disruption within the brain, and the brain's responsible for initiating movements, the brain's responsible for thinking and problem-solving and those kinds of things. So when we disrupt the brain, we can disrupt those inhibitory control mechanisms that help us to stop, think, and those kinds of things. So we can see also an array of kind of behavioral or emotional symptoms following a concussion. Increased emotionality would be an example. So being tearful and not really knowing exactly why. Lower frustration tolerance. You know, just anger and those kinds of things where the inhibitory control mechanism to kind of put the brakes on being overly emotional or what we call labile are not really working as well as they should be. Those are pretty much the typical behavioral emotional issues we see with concussion.
Now, you work with children. So when we're talking about children and we're talking about these behavioral effects, what age range are we talking about?
Well, in our clinic, we see kiddos as young as 4 years old. Sometimes it's very difficult to tease apart kind of where they were before the concussion and where they are currently when we see them in the office. But we see kids ages, you know, 4 all the way up till 21, 22. And the profiles tend to look pretty similar. I think one needs to have a good understanding of normal child development when they kind of take a look at a kiddo who comes into the clinic who has a concussion.
Well, you've almost answered or certainly led me into my next question, which is how does a parent tell if this is their child being their child or if this is the effects of a concussion?
That's a great question. I would take a step back and say that, yes, concussions do occur with a degree of frequency. And indeed, you do not have to have loss of consciousness in order to diagnose or to sustain a concussion. So that should be a pretty clear point there. But, you know, the brain is protected pretty well in the skull. There is cerebral spinal fluid that provides a degree of cushioning. There's a variety of other layers within the brain or coverings that kind of provide additional support. And then we have the skull, which is a pretty robust vault for the brain to sit in. And so if a child is, you know, walking and kind of bumps their head on a coffee table and they're crying immediately afterwards and there's kind of no change in cognition, no change in thinking, they don't seem confused, then I would be less inclined to think it was something like a concussion. But there's actually kind of two pieces to that. So when we see an athlete, for example, we tend to be fairly conservative. So if we have a kiddo who's playing basketball, they get hit in the head with a ball, they go down, they get up, they the coach or athletic trainer does a kind of a brief cognitive screener with them. Kiddo seems like they're paying attention pretty well. There's no memory issues. They know what they're doing. They seem, you know, broadly from a motor standpoint to be doing okay. We still would prefer that kiddo sit out because there's an increased likelihood that they could sustain yet another concussion from the game. So that's kind of one of the things that we consider when we're evaluating whether a concussion has occurred. It's, yeah, has a concussion occurred, but also, you know, how conservative do we really need to be here? Because If the kid is going right back into something where they can get another concussion versus they're just going to go hang out and do normal kid stuff, then we can be more liberal or conservative.
So tell us what the brief cognitive screener is that a coach may administer to a child. What are the questions that are asked?
That's a good question. Usually orientation is a big piece. So where are you? What are you doing? What were we just doing? Those kinds of things. So just getting a better idea of if the child is aware of kind of what just transpired. It all depends, I think, on the coach and the team and kind of what protocols they use on the sidelines. But maybe saying numbers in forward sequence. So say a set of numbers like 5, 2, 1, 7, and have the child say them back. Visual tracking, those kinds of things are pretty typical that they do on the sideline. But again, I'm hopeful that with increased awareness for concussion that we're more conservative, especially on the sideline, because there is that risk going back into the game that something like this is going to occur again. And I'd also argue that if an individual has a concussion and maybe a coach or trainer or the child themselves didn't kind of pick up on it and they go back in the game, if they did have a concussion, they're probably not as sharp as they were before, which can lead to yet another concussion. So that's why we want to be really conservative.
So I want to make sure I understand. If a child has what might be a head injury in a game, and the coach administers a brief cognitive screener, and the child seems to be okay, you would still like, whether the coach administers the screener or not, you would still like that child to sit out the game that day. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a judgment call, but by and large, the adage that we use is when in doubt, sit it out.
Okay. And for the child who is perhaps has not had a concussion and does go back in the game, are you saying that child, simply by virtue of having had some sort of an impact, is at greater risk for another negative impact versus a child who is not?
Well, not necessarily. I guess it depends on – I guess I would go back to say if, the game looks like it's an aggressive game. So if it's a hockey game where, you have two teams that are, strong adversaries and, there has been a lot of hitting or some rough play, then, yes, there's increased risk for future injury.
Okay.
What I'm saying otherwise, though, is – if a child has a concussion, it can affect their thinking, learning, and processing, which then can put them at greater risk. I guess if they had some other type of injury, like a sprained ankle or a subclinical sprain or something along those lines, then that could put them at greater risk as well, but not necessarily for a concussion.
The idea of children and playing contact or impact sports. I mean, certainly that it's very popular. Girls and boys are more and more engaged in a broad range of activities with the support and advocacy of parents and many professionals. Are you concerned about that? Do you want there to be a different way that children are encouraged to play?
Well, we do know that children, when they sustain a concussion, they're kind of similar to adult models, meaning that, an adult sustaining a concussion is pretty similar to a child, though we do know that kiddos take a little bit longer to recover from that concussion. So I do think that, and then we also know that, prior concussions are good predictors of future concussions. So when we get to the point where we have kids who are in contact or impact sports, where there is one concussion a season or in that child, I mean, that's one concussion is kind of too many. But at the same time, we also don't want to completely limit the opportunity for play. So I do think safety is an issue that continues to need to be addressed. And I think, collecting data as to, mechanisms of concussion will be really helpful going forward and putting safety measures into place to reduce the risk further.
How is a concussion treated?
So concussions are treated oftentimes, well, I would say at I'll give the Children's Hospital here as a model. So we work with the community. We've developed a great concussion consortium within Orange County, California here, where we provide education and support for professionals in the community, clinicians, for athletic trainers. So I would say concussion treatment or management starts on the field, assuming that it happens in a sporting event, with the athletic trainer being familiar with what symptoms to look for and pulling the child out. Then, depending on the severity of the injury, then there's maybe a trip to the emergency department where there's an evaluation, where there may or may not be neuroimaging to further explore whether there's a bleed or something along those lines. And then oftentimes the child is discharged to home with a whole list of things to kind of look out for during the immediate recovery phase of concussion. And then what we do is encourage the child to follow up with their pediatrician or primary care physician. Many of the ones that we work with in the community have had good education on concussion management. And those kids usually do fairly well with some time. And then if they're not doing well, then sometimes they'll be moved on to kind of a sports medicine physician in the community or an orthopedist who would do another evaluation and continue to monitor the child. And then if they're still not doing well then they usually get to our multidisciplinary concussion clinic at the Children's Hospital, where I work alongside a neurologist, and we concurrently see the child and try to figure out what's going on, and more importantly, are there alternative explanations to explain why this child is having such a protracted or lengthy recovery that's beyond expectation?
And when that child is sent home, what should his or her activities be or not be at home?
So we do want to restrict activity, but there's a great study out of the Medical College of Wisconsin that demonstrates that if we provide 48 hours of rest and quiet versus 1 week of cocooning, where the child doesn't receive, has no exposure to school, no exposure to TV, no exposure to conversation, that the child who actually has 48 hours of rest and kind of slowly ramps up actually does better than the child where you have complete deprivation of environmental stressors.
So when that child is sent home, there's not a great deal for the child or the parent to do other than to be careful and for the parent to monitor the child's presentation.
Absolutely, and symptom management. So we want the child to be comfortable. So headache management, and then, avoiding situations. So we know that, most concussions, again, they respond and recover. These kids do get better, but we want to put them in a situation where they have the opportunity to do that. So I would say, again, slowly after maybe 48 hours, kind of go back to school, take some classes in the morning. If you're having some problems or headache or some of those kinds of things, then I would say, go to the nurse's station or maybe go home. But then after a couple of days, try to ramp up to almost full time. It all depends on the child and the recovery, but we're always trying to kind of push the envelope a little bit. If we see symptoms, then we back it off a little bit, and then we kind of slowly move forward again. The longer a child's out, the worse their functional prognosis is.
So it sounds like after about a week, a child with a concussion that is not going to have long-lasting effects, a week should kind of have that child up and running again.
Well, there are sport guidelines, they essentially say that they're in place if a child has a concussion that they cannot play essentially for a full week before they return to sport.
Okay.
So by and large, 1 week sounds reasonable, but sometimes kids take a couple weeks and maybe a month or so.
Okay. Dr. Romaine, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to continue with this conversation about concussions, behavioral impacts, emotional effects, and more. We'll be right back, folks. I'm Pamela Brewer, and you're listening to Mind Talk. Dr. Romaine, so far we've been talking about children who have been reasonably okay prior to having a concussion, and then what do parents look for and what are the next steps? What about the situations in which a child has a pre-existing mental health issue or a learning disability? Is the protocol different?
The protocol is fairly similar, but you raise a very good point. Concussions usually, severity of the actual concussion is important to consider when we look at the recovery process, but we also want to consider premorbid factors. So if there is a premorbid history of learning disability, or if there's premorbid or pre-existing anxiety or mood issues or something along those lines, or family stressors, what usually happens is they can exacerbate or worsen the concussion and even prolong concussion recovery.
Is there a diagnostic range of experiences or a range of learning disabilities that would lead you to say to that parent, your child probably should not play these kinds of sports, period?
Typically, I look at the history, because past behavior is the best predictor of future behavior. So if we have a kiddo who comes into the clinic and they're on their fifth concussion and they're in eighth grade and they haven't even started high school yet and they like to play football, or they're the hockey player and they're, you know, the bruiser for the hockey team and they're aggressive players, then we have a conversation about, hey, what are we doing here? What are the plans for the sport? Is this something that's going to be a lifetime career? We need to be mindful that, you know, you've had concussions in the past and there may be future concussions based on, you know, based on your history. And you know, and what are we doing? We really don't know what the long-term consequences are of multiple concussions. But I would err toward the side of saying, hey, if you've had a bunch of concussions and you're at great risk for having future concussions, you really need to consider, you know, what you're doing and where you're going. So in specific answer to your question, I can't think of too many things. Maybe a child who has ADHD, and again, they have a history of multiple concussions or a lot of injuries, then we'd have a little bit more of a discussion about, hey, you know, you're, because of your, you know, the issues that you're kind of bringing to the table, and issues maybe with impulsivity or judgment, this might not be the best sport for you. And maybe we can find a different sport or some other type of activity that has a lower risk.
So it's not that a child, for example, with a mental health situation or learning disability can't play sports. It's just that you want to be mindful of the impact of those pre-existing conditions on what may happen in a sports environment.
Absolutely. There are multiple variables, and I think that that's one of the things that I love about working in the concussion clinic is that, you know, you're balancing out multiple factors. One, you know, the pre-existing. The second would be kind of the family situation. You know, how much support is there? Another would be the sport that they're doing. Another would be, you know, how's their academic career going? Because I'm of the opinion that, you know, that school is really for learning and laying a foundation so that you can be successful once you graduate and move on and continue to open doors. So I personally view sports as somewhat secondary. And so if a child is having learning difficulties and is struggling academically already, you know, maybe we shouldn't be doing football. But we could also be active and we can do things that might not be as time consuming or cause a greater risk for having a concussion. But we really want to avoid the kiddo who's kind of teetering academically from derailing even further because of a concussion. But, you know, again, there's no clear answer. It's usually having a conversation with family and kind of weighing the pros and cons out.
There are certain symptoms that you have explained that may be a result of a concussion that could also maybe be a learning disability. You know, I'm thinking about being confused, memory issues, even irritability sometimes. So how does a parent sort of hone in on maybe my child has a learning disability, versus a concussion? I ask that in part because we know that there are children who are going out and they're playing and they're getting hit and they're not going to tell their parents. Maybe they were in a battle at school. They're not going to go home necessarily and tell their parents they had a head injury. So how's a parent to tell which is which?
Well, usually when we have a learning disability in place, there is either a very obvious signs or even subtle signs that we can trace back to, you know, early first grade and second grade and those kinds of things. So that helps. So getting kind of a history or figuring out. And when we consider concussion, it's usually there's a pretty marked change immediately. So learning disability is kind of more of a slow thing that kind of maybe progresses over time. It doesn't necessarily progress, actually. It's that academic challenges increase, so the learning disability can actually look worse. Whereas concussion is pretty, you know, all of a sudden there's kind of a change from one moment to the next. Usually I find, and there's been several kids we've worked with where they didn't tell their parents that they had a concussion, in part because they didn't really know it was that serious, but sometimes they were trying to kind of hide the fact that they did have a concussion.
Right.
And what usually happens is, you know, a week later, they go to the movies with their friends and they come back and they have like a, you know, horrendous headache, or there's some other type of physical symptom, you know, noises bother them or hearing things, you know, like loud sounds bother them. And they finally kind of fess up, oh, hey, you know what, I hit my head and I was, you know, trying to power through it, and you know what, I'm just nauseous all the time, or my head's really bad. So usually we see physical symptoms that accompany the cognitive symptoms, and I'd argue that the physical symptoms in concussion are more common than the cognitive symptoms, especially a week or two out.
Okay.
And so when it comes to learning disability, you know, that's more of a prolonged thing.
And can a learning disability be diagnosed in first or second grade?
Yes, you can diagnose a learning disability early on, especially if it's a severe learning disability. I would say that the most common learning disability, which is a developmental reading disability or dyslexia, we want to be a little bit careful in diagnosing that early on because we want the child to have adequate exposure to pre-reading and reading skills before we say, oh, there's a reading disability here. If the child hasn't had any exposure to reading, they can have problems with, you know, phonological processing and those kinds of things. So we want to be very careful in kindergarten and first grade, you know, identifying something like as significant as a developmental reading disability. And usually by second or third grade, it becomes a little bit more clear.
Speaking of learning disabilities, where you and I are talking about it is everybody who's listening knows what a learning disability is. So maybe that's on me. Maybe we need to back up a bit. What is a learning disability?
So a learning disability is, it's a good question. It's something that I deal with every day, but, you know, thinking about kind of the core definition, is an inability secondary to a certain circumscribed weakness. So that is that you have, you know, broadly overall strong abilities, but there's a weakness in a particular area. I guess that's the best way I would define it, just kind of thinking off the top of my head, is that it's a relative weakness in a circumscribed area, in one area. So again, developmental reading disability. The vast majority of individuals with developmental reading disability are of, you know, average to above average, to even well above average globally, like using the term IQ. But they have a circumscribed weakness in phonological processing or some other area that's making it difficult for them to learn. So what we see is a discrepancy between their academic achievement in, say, reading or math, whatever the disability is, relative to their other abilities in day-to-day functions.
Is it true that once you have a learning disability, you always have a learning disability, or is there a cure?
I think a learning disability can be remediated for sure. So what that means is that with dedication, with support, with accommodations, one can work through a learning disability. It kind of depends on the severity because learning disabilities are on a continuum. You can have a mild degree of developmental reading disability or you can be severely quote-unquote dyslexic. Usually when it's pretty severe and it's impairing, it usually follows you. But again, there are ways to work around it. There's some fantastic things because, again, reading disability is such a, is the most common learning disability. There's so many ways to kind of work around that. There's, auditory books, there's speech to text, there's for Word documents, spell check and those kinds of things to help a person who struggles with spelling. So there are ways to work around it if that reading or that learning disability is something that's kind of sticking longer than it should.
And what about dyslexia? What exactly is that? What does it look like in terms of its disabling, potentially disabling impact?
So dyslexia is just a fancy term for developmental reading disability.
Okay.
At the core of the vast majority of all developmental reading disabilities or dyslexias is a problem with phonological processing. Most people think that dyslexia is kind of a vision problem, that you're seeing things backwards. Where in fact, what that is that we often see kids flipping letters and sometimes flipping words like the B's and D's. It's because they sound similar. So B sounds a lot like D, and if you have a phonological processing problem, you struggle to distinguish between the B and the D sound, as an example. And so oftentimes the child is like, well, I hear the same sound, and it's a ball with a line on one end versus a ball with a line on the other end. So sometimes they're going to get it wrong. So essentially, again, a developmental reading disability is by and large not a problem with vision or seeing things backwards or somehow wrong. It's a problem with phonological processing, the inability to distinguish between speech sounds.
I'm glad that you made the distinction a few moments ago that one can have a learning disability in one area and be quite skilled in another. Because certainly there are still those pockets of folks who may think that if you have a learning disability, it means you're just dumb. You're just not as smart as everybody else.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. In my experience, after having been working with kids for in excess of 15 years now, I have been seeing the shift to having greater understanding and greater awareness of that learning disabilities are just that. There's a particular weakness, or again, I use the term circumscribed weakness in one particular area. And in fact, I often see individuals who have amazing skills in other areas. So, for example, I can think of a friend of mine who's got a developmental reading disability, but or at least historically has had one, but is a fantastic musician. There's physicians that I've worked with who in passing and talking with me say, "Yeah, I had a reading disability, and they're doing fantastic." So there's always something that even if you have a learning disability, you can find ways A to work around it, and then B, other things in life that don't really tax that learning disability so much.
As you know, very often when the child experiences a challenge of some sort, the mom or the dad will assume that it's their fault that they caused it, and thus that they're bad parents. Does talk about that in relationship to the experience of learning disability in the family.
Well, most of the families that I work with have tried so many things, have gone above and beyond. And you got to remember that when a child has a learning disability, one of the things they need to do is they need to practice, 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 and keep working at it. Well, think of adults. If there's something that you don't like doing, like for example, I'm not the most adept at playing basketball, so therefore I don't play basketball. But if you had to make me practice basketball every day, I wouldn't be happy doing it because I'd be making, more errors than having success. And I think the same holds true with learning disability. So I see that, parents do have an uphill battle in the sense that, the child struggles and therefore is not going to want to do the work, not going to want to, continue to push and push and push and work harder and harder and harder. So it's a challenge for a lot of these parents. So to go back, I would say that most of the parents, when they come in, yes, sometimes they'll say that, they wish they could have done more or they feel that it's their fault somehow, but most of them have gone above and beyond. They're just frustrated because that's what a learning disability is. It's a particular weakness that just is, and it needs to be worked through, and it takes time.
Is
There
there
is, there, I will say that there is a genetic heritability piece to it that we see, upwards of, I think it's between 60 and 70% of individuals who have a developmental reading disability in the family are at risk for having a reading disability. So there is a genetic heritability.
Okay. And so once the child has been diagnosed as having a learning disability, and there are things that he or she can do along with the parents, are there any things that you particularly get concerned about in terms of that child's development or care?
Well, I think that there's probably a couple answers to that, or a couple things that come to mind. One is, we don't want to miss any, again, I use the term comorbidity, so a co-occurring symptom or disorder or disability. So we know that, unfortunately, individuals who have a learning disability are at greater risk for some mental health issues, including things like, you know, depression, and also ADHD and ADD and those kinds of things. So there are situations where we have kiddos who have a reading disability, and that's being addressed, but there's also a secondary ADD or an attentive problem or some other type of factor that's also causing some noise or some difficulty with learning. So we want to make sure that we address those. So that would be the one concern that I would have, is that are we just lumping everything under learning disability, and are we not paying attention to some other factors that could be at play? And then the second would be to make sure that the school is aware of, you know, kind of what's going on and how they're managing the child's learning experience.
I know you don't work with adults, but if you have a child who has been diagnosed with a learning disability, is it reasonable to assume that that child growing into adulthood will continue to have the learning disability, or could there be some diminishment or disappearance of the disability?
Well, absolutely. There can be remediation that can occur. If we catch it sooner, we're in a better shape. And so when I look at, for example, use reading disability, if we address a reading disability, again, it's really hard to identify a reading disability at age 5 or 6. But if we're at like age 8 or 9, that's a great ideal time to catch a reading disability. Or I'll go back to reading disability. We want to catch it around, you know, early elementary school, because we can make the greatest gains. If we catch this reading disability at age 12, at age 14, at age 18, it's going to be harder for the brain to kind of compensate for some of the phonological processing difficulties that have not been addressed previously. So it kind of all depends on when you catch it. It also it depends on the severity of that learning disability, and then also what tools are in place to work around that learning disability. That would be to the extent to which I could predict what the future might look like for the child who's now an adult who had a learning disability.
Okay. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Dr. Jonathan Romaine, who is with Chalk Children's Hospital in Orange County, California. Dr. Romaine is board certified in clinical neuropsychology and pediatric neuropsychology. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Dr. Romaine, is there a difference in terms of concussions when it occurs with, for a first time, for example, with an older teen or a young adult versus a younger child? Is recovery more complicated? Does it take a longer time? Those kinds of things.
I wouldn't say that the recovery would necessarily be more complicated for a younger child. Usually we do find that the younger ones tend to take a little bit longer to recover. So sometimes for adults it might be, you know, days, maybe a week or so. For adolescents it might be a little bit longer, and then for the younger ones it's a little longer. I think that, again, going back to more so the environment than the actual injury itself, my greatest concern is for individuals who sustain a concussion at certain milestones. You know, so the one who just started high school, right? So high school is a time when now they're going to different classes, they have a locker, there's greater responsibility, the high school, the teachers are, you know, in support of independence and those kinds of things, and lo and behold, in the first week of high school, the child sustains a concussion. That child, in my opinion, if they had a concussion maybe 2 years prior in elementary or in middle school, they might not have as many struggles, or it might not be as challenging because, again, the environment is different between those two, between high school and middle school and elementary school. So I would say environment is a huge factor in concussion recovery.
Knowing, I confess, almost nothing about football. So I'm going to ask you a helmet question. But be clear,
okay.
I have no idea what you're saying when you answer. Do you have any concerns about the way in which helmets are constructed for children, adolescents, young adults who are playing football? Is it enough? Is it not? Is it too much? What are your thoughts?
That's really a good question. I'll also have to profess that I don't have expertise in the sports equipment that's currently being used for kids, and I know they're making great strides because it's such an evolving process to speak to, you know, what the companies are currently doing. I will say, though, that those concussion-preventing headbands and those kinds of devices that some people will use for, say, soccer, for example, they haven't really shown to be very protective. So using that it's oftentimes a, I forget the material that they use. It's kind of like they use for sweatsuit material that has a little bit of give. It doesn't seem at this point, at least in the studies that I've read, where they provide a significant degree of protection. So I can't really answer the football helmet question very well, but I can say that a lot of these other aids and supports to you know, prevent concussion in soccer and those kinds of things haven't really shown to be super promising in the research I have read.
Interesting. And I feel great that you, too, don't know about helmets. Now I don't feel quite so out of the loop when it comes to sports. Still with the sports question, are there sports being played now that do not require helmets that you kind of wish did?
That's a tough question. I don't know if I could answer that all that well. I do know that there is some research out there with soccer that that says that, you know, if you do a certain number of headers per year, that can have a cumulative effect. So I can't say definitively what that number is off the top of my head, but maybe it's in excess of 1,000 headers per year can actually potentially cause some changes in cognitive functioning as measured by neurocognitive or neuropsychological tests. So again, I can't really say, what I will say is that helmets don't prevent head injury or concussion. They can lessen some of the severity of it. So just saying, hey, let's throw a helmet on a child who's a soccer player, it could still change the dynamics of soccer, where soccer becomes that much more of an impact sport as opposed to a contact sport. So I want to, you know, be mindful of how the game could be changed with using a helmet.
All right, I think I understand what you just said, but I'm going to ask you a really dumb question. So are you ready for it?
Absolutely.
What's a header?
A header, yeah. So in soccer, it's when the ball so in soccer, you can't use your arms, right? You can only use, you can use the rest of your body. So oftentimes when the ball is being kicked in the air, sometimes being thrown from the sideline, the athlete can use their head to either propel the ball forward or to trap the ball and drop the ball in front of them so they can actually use their feet to kick the ball. So a header is when the ball, when they're taking impact with from the ball to the head.
So let's keep it a secret between you and me that I had no idea what you were talking about when you said header. We won't let anybody know.
Well, hopefully our soccer fans in the crowd will be familiar with that term.
And forgive me. Parents clearly want the best for their children at all times. And there are lots of parents, though, who have grown up in a time, certainly the older parents, perhaps, where the child was supposed to just pull him or herself up out of bed, go to school, do their work, and be done with it. So for those parents who say, there's nothing wrong with my child, he's just lazy, she doesn't know how to pay attention, I'm going to punish them into behaving well, what do you say?
Well, we know that punishment is very effective in the immediacy, but it actually doesn't have a lot of long-term benefits. So consistent punishment is not going to get the desired behavior you want, which is the kiddo, you know, going to school, doing well, and those kinds of things. I think there's multiple factors. And, you know, I mean, is it possible that a child's lazy or they're just being oppositional? Absolutely. But what I would like to do is I'd like to, me personally as a neuropsychologist, is rule out some other factors that might not be in the control of the child. I think, you know, a pretty significant case of ADHD is, you know, is something where the child really doesn't have control over that, or a learning disability, or some emotional or mental health issue like depression or anxiety. It's not something that, it's, you know, it's at the level of the brain. And so I would want to, as a parent or and even as a clinician, I would like to rule out other factors. And then if it ends up just being laziness, well, then we have things that we need to work on. So it's not a matter of just giving a child a free pass and saying, hey, you know, let's just make life as easy as possible, because life is full of challenges. But we want to be mindful of those challenges that exceed the child's ability or the parent's ability to kind of manage, so that we can pull in professionals who can help to give that little boost, or what I like to call a floor of opportunity for them to be successful. So treating the ADHD, helping with the depression, helping with some other learning disability or some other factor, so that the child can then excel. Most children do want to be successful. Most children do want to succeed. So looking at what are the factors that are contributing to them not succeeding, and addressing those.
For those folks who are familiar with ADHD, or somewhat familiar, is ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is that a learning disability or is that something different?
Well, I would call it a neurobehavioral disability. So essentially, it's neurologically mediated, meaning that it's brain-related. Not to say that a learning disability isn't, but it's clearly brain-related, and then there's this outward behavior, and that behavior is categorized by, you know, inattention, problems with organization, impulsivity, disinhibition, and those kinds of things. So I would say that it falls within the realm of mental health, but it is actually a neurological or neurobehavioral condition. But some schools, and depends on the district and depends on the state, could potentially categorize that, at least in terms of getting special education support, as a learning disability, or what they call an other health impairment in the special education world.
And for those children, whether it's ADHD or something else, any of the learning disabilities that we've talked about and others, is it reasonable for a parent to imagine that at some point that child is going to experience depression and or anxiety related to the fact of the disability?
Not necessarily, but we do know that there is an increased risk. So if we have, it's either a medical condition or even these other neurobehavioral things that we've discussed, including, you know, multiple concussions and those kinds of things, that they are at greater risk. I wouldn't, you know, just automatically assume that since a child has ADHD that they're going to have depression or anxiety. But, you know, let's put it this way. If a child has ADHD and they feel like they can't do anything right, and, you know, they're the child that's in the family or in the school where, you know, there's just never, you know, the child's name is said, and then it's always stop doing that or don't do this, then, you know, that can obviously affect the kiddo's self-esteem. Like, hey, I can't do anything right. Kids with ADD and ADHD and oppositional behaviors, they tend to do, you know, more negative things or kind of get into trouble more than they do positive things. And so that alone can cause them to have a self-esteem issue, which can cause, you know, depression and anxiety. Like, hey, I just can't do anything right. So that degree of what we call learned helplessness.
We certainly hear a great deal in the world today about the opioid crisis. Would you say that children and adults have a greater possibility of using drugs as a way to lessen some of the uncomfortable expressions of a learning disability than others? Could that be, could the child who is using drugs be a child who has a learning disability and they're trying to navigate it themselves?
I think that a child who has, or a young adult who has depression or anxiety, is more likely to seek out ways to feel better, and sometimes those ways include illicit substances. So not necessarily a learning disability or reading disability increasing that risk, but it's a learning disability or reading disability and failure in school and low self-worth or anxiety and or depression that leads to using medications to try to feel better. So there is an increased risk in that type of use, but it's not, I don't think it's directly related to learning disabilities per se. It's kind of the artifact or the consequence, the potential consequence, social environmental consequences of learning disability.
Gotcha. We certainly know that parents want their children to do well, be well, and some even burden themselves and their children with the notion that they need to be perfect. And clearly, I would suggest that while some parents may almost feel they'd rather their child have a concussion than a learning disability, the theory being a concussion, you know, it's going to heal and go away, learning disability maybe not so much. What do you say to parents who really are struggling with the notion that their child has a learning disability or potentially has a learning disability?
Well, first off, I would say that, you know, the fact that we identified what it is a first step, and it is miles ahead of where they were prior to knowing that this is what's really going on for the kiddo. So I could kind of say, like, oh, this is almost only going to get better from here as long as we can continue to address it. So having that kind of degree of optimism, but also, you know, being realistic and saying, hey, there are going to be some challenges. You know, I guess, you know, being in the field where I see, most of the families I see coming into the clinic, they have questions or they have concerns or there's something that's not going right. So I guess I appreciate that, you know, not variety is the spice of life, but that, you know, adversities can turn into strengths. And the child that's uniformly broadly within the average range and every domain assessed, I don't usually see them, but that, I don't know, to me, that's considered average. It's that child who has a weakness in some area who can kind of overcome that and be really successful or has an amazing strength in another area, you know, as an offsetting that weakness in some other area. That's where, you know, the strength is like this child can be extremely successful. You just have to work harder at it early on. To try to navigate, remediate, and all those kinds of things. But, you know, you also, you know, try to look for those opportunities for them to be successful. And I think that even though a child has a learning disability, it doesn't mean that they can't be extremely successful. And even, I would argue, sometimes more successful than the quote-unquote neurotypical or the average across-the-board kiddo.
Well, I think the other thing you're saying, too, is that we all have something that we are challenged with doing.
Oh, absolutely. You should see me on the basketball court.
I think I got that. The sense that children can be so vulnerable to so many things can be kind of daunting for parents. So again, you know, the notion that the parent is indestructible, their child is indestructible, it kind of doesn't really help anybody, and it puts a lot of pressure on both parent and child.
Oh, absolutely. I think we need to be realistic that, you know, we can't put our child, you know, completely in bubble wrap. and prevent, experiences from happening. There's going to be social setbacks. There are going to be academic challenges. I think it's, I don't remember, it was Rob Reiner or maybe his father said, I've learned more from my failures than my successes, or I've grown more as a result of those. And I mean, I think that's important. It's important to have challenges. It's important to say, hey, when is it too much? And when do we kind of switch gears? Or when do we find an alternative strategy? Or when do we persevere through it? I mean, that's what kind of defines what character is. And I think, completely, putting a barrier so that a child or even as an adult doesn't experience those things, I think that can actually affect, ability to be successful in the future, and independence and those kinds of things.
How important is it for a parent to alert a school that their child may have been or has been diagnosed with a learning disability?
Well, I think it's important to be tactful. So I would say if it's something in the realm of a learning disability, that's something that, the child's going to school to be educated. So I think by and large, you want to have an open communication around learning disabilities. If there was outside evaluations, I know with my evaluations that I do, I try to be very mindful of what the schools can and can't do and try to build a bridge between parents and schools so that way we can best help the child. So, again, that's how I write my reports and that's how I encourage parents to proceed working with schools. So I think open communication for learning disabilities. As it relates to things that may or may not have direct influence on school functioning, I would be, a little bit more cautious. So if there's, a mental health diagnosis that is being managed and it does not have any, major impact in the school, there's a reason for privacy in that regard or in that instance.
So it sounds like you really want the parents to think about what they would hope to achieve for the child in disclosing a diagnosis.
Absolutely. And again, as it relates to learning disability, if the child's going to school to learn, then I think the individuals who are working with the child day in and day out need to be aware of, A, what's going on, and B, they can collaborate with the family to find the best, possible route to success for their child.
Dr. Jonathan Romaine, once again, thank you for coming back on our program. You are always filled with such wonderful information and understandable information. How do folks get more information about CHOC Children's?
It's a good question. So I'm not the social media butterfly that I profess to be, but so on the website CHOC.org, there's some great concussion information that we have through the Neurosciences Institute through CHOC Children's Hospital. Again, you can get that online. I think there's also they have Instagram and tweets and all that other kind of stuff. So there's ways. It's all through the internet these days.
Well, from one non-social butterfly to another, thank you again so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure.
And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a mental health, medical health, or other professional. You can always listen to Mind Talk on demand by going to myndtalk.org. I'd love to hear from you. You can send an email to me at Pamela, Pamela, at mindtalk.org with any of your questions or comments. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's just unacceptable. You take care.